Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Beth Macy, author of Dopesick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, published this month by Little Brown & Company. Beth is a journalist who writes about outsiders and underdogs. Her writing has won more than a dozen national journalism awards, including a Nieman Fellowship for Journalism at Harvard, and the 2013 J. Anthony Lucas Wart and Progress Award for Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. She's also the author of another fascinating book, Truvine. Dopesick is the story of one drug, OxyContin, and how it has and is destroying a good part of America, and how one company managed to make this happen, or start the spiral of this thing. OxyContin is a powerful drug, administered for pain but abused by thousands, if not millions. It is also truly a gateway drug, leading to the abuse of other high-powered pharmaceuticals, heroin, and now drugs like fentanyl. As it works its way along the I-81 corridor, and now further and further out, it destroys lives, families, homes, marriages, and takes lives indiscriminately. Greed, fed by unemployment and despair, combined to create a cocktail that takes down entire families, especially those who are already under stress from the loss of their job, funds, and hope. It's a juggernaut whose spread may not yet be controlled with the tools at hand. Beth chronicles the rise of this drug, its dissemination, the heroes that have tried to curtail its use and production, and those who have fallen prey to its deadly lore. With that, welcome, Beth, and thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Sam.
So how did you first learn of this drug and the opioid crisis, in quotes, that is such a buzzword today?
Yeah, well, I sort of like backtracked. I started reporting on heroin in my community in Roanoke, Virginia. I was a longtime newspaper reporter at the Roanoke Times. I started reporting when heroin landed in the suburbs, in the wealthy suburbs outside of Roanoke, in the county, in 2010. And everyone went, holy crap, wealthy white kids are doing heroin? What? What did we miss? And I did this three-part series that followed the travails of two families whose lives were upended by this drug. One overdosed and died. The other was about to go to prison for his role in his former classmate's death. And these were private school kids and, you know, just, quote, great kids that got mixed up into these drugs. And so when I started looking into this as a book, someone pointed out, you know, that it all began with the arrival of OxyContin in the mid-90s, and this whole notion being pushed by Big Pharma, which was that pain was being under-treated, and now we needed to consider pain as a, quote, fifth vital sign. And so I started to sort of draw a narrative line between OxyContin to heroin, to the fentanyl analogs that you're seeing today that are taking so many lives. And that was, so really kind of backtracked and went back to some rural communities 3-4 hours from where I live in Roanoke, where the impact of OxyContin abuse had really first taken hold.
God, I had one experience, one and only one experience with OxyContin. And it was prescribed to me for something ridiculous, like maybe wisdom tooth or quadrant gingivitis, and I didn't really know they were time released, and so I cut in half, which was a mistake, and took it, and I will never take it again because it just took me back to my college days, and I didn't want to be taken back there.
Yeah, and you never know how you're going to react, right? I mean, that's the thing. For some people, it feels like the best thing they've ever experienced in their life, and you know, within a week they must want more. But like when I've taken an opioid post surgery, they just make me feel really ill. So, you know, I consider myself lucky for that.
Yeah, and I have a very non-addictive personality. But actually, that's a good question. I mean, I suppose I could become addicted to gambling because I like playing roulette, but I specifically limit myself to a certain amount of money. What about these people, you know, especially that one kid who was such a brawny guy working day to day, functioning at a very high level? Yeah. I mean, what is it that...
So this is a kid, Jesse Bolstridge, and the book begins with his mother, Christy Fernandez.
Right.
They live in rural Shenandoah Valley, Virginia, just gorgeous farm country, right? and her son was the light of like his football team. You know, he could make the crowd roar simply by running onto the field and pumping his hands. Never met a stranger. And after high school, he worked in construction. Never missed a day of work. And the book begins with her asking me to find out what happened. Why did her son, her only son, end up dead on somebody else's bathroom floor with a needle in his arm? She didn't understand it. And so when we sort of, you know, she and I both sort of investigating this, not only from the angle of a heroin dealer landing in their small community, but also from the angle of, you know, when he was 4 and 5 years old, he was one of those kids that just had a motor that wouldn't ever stop. You know, he'd fall asleep mid-play with a car in each hand, a little toy car in each hand. And he was one of those kids that was put on Ritalin at an early age. And then, like many of the young people that I interviewed, and families of the young people that I interviewed, a lot of folks that ended up, I just noticed anecdotally, a lot of folks ended up on heroin, had started misusing their ADHD medications in their teenage years, either trading them for harder drugs or using them. Some teenagers use them so they can stay up all night drinking without, you know, passing out. And it becomes sort of this other thing that gets traded around, and it can lead to, you know, more serious drug addiction and use. And the research, if you see as I parse it out in the book, isn't quite clear. Some people think, most people agree that it has been overdiagnosed ADHD, but some people think untreated ADHD can lead to addiction. Other studies say just the opposite, that it is feeding into this, and that's one of those things. I mean, they call it practicing medicine, and the science just isn't clear on that at the moment.
Yeah, you know, that is heartbreaking, that story, but in two situations, one in which I could see them, one in which I couldn't, the photographs, especially when they're kids, you know, playing on the mm-hmm. playground, and, you know, you got two friends that end up both in the same boat, and you know, and it's only like 6 or 8 years from the day those pictures were taken when they were so innocent. And that really struck me. And then what also struck me were the photographs I could see, which are the ones that you began each part with. And they're so stark, and the context of them gives you this idea of despair. How did you choose those pictures?
Well, a photographer that I had long worked with at the Roanoke Times, I mean, we did every big project that I ever wrote, that I was ever proud of, that I ever won a big award for, was with this photographer named Josh Meltzer. He's now professor at Rochester Institute of Technology. And he had limited time to shoot the pictures for this book. I asked him if he would be part of it, and he wanted to. So he came down just like 3 or 4 weekends to shoot those pictures. And we knew that we wanted to show some of the scenery and the landscape. I mean, especially when you go to rural Virginia, Appalachia, central Appalachia, and you see the rusted out coal tipples, and sit against the backdrop is this gorgeous mountain scenery, and you see, you know, just the despair and the crumbling buildings and things like that. That's one part of the story. But also, if you look at the cover of the book, it's a really nice suburb called Hidden Valley, which is ironic, right, given the way the problem right. was hidden for so long and then was allowed, because of that stigma and shame, was sort of allowed to fester and grow. But, you know, this is a drug that doesn't discriminate, and this drug really took hold of that community. And so that's why I'm really happy that that's the cover image. Josh chose that, or he suggested it, and the publisher agreed that that was the image to go with on the cover. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is one of the moms, whose kids went to a private school in that region, said it was like a Dementor from Harry Potter came into Hidden Valley and said, I want you, and I want you, and I want you. The way the epidemic spread, you know, socially, as you know, in groups of people that we're still seeing play out. I mean, these are these kids I wrote about in 2010. I mean, we're still seeing that play out with some of the people, including the young woman I write about named Tess at the end of the book. Is that all that same social group that started experimenting with OxyContin in the early years? Then when the OxyContin became reformulated in 2010 and harder to abuse, they went on to other opioid pills. And then when those pills got harder to get, they went to heroin. And now, of course, you have fentanyl in the heroin supply. So you're just playing Russian roulette every time.
And the fentanyl is so incredibly powerful. And then, you know, you look at Prince, you look at Tom Petty, and, you know, they're loaded with it. And, you know, there's reasons for it. I understand that. But it's just the potency of it is phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah. And then, I mean, people are mail ordering it on the dark web.
Jeez.
There was somebody at the local community college arrested recently for selling 700, quote, Xanax bars, but they were actually fentanyl pills that have been manufactured and mailed ordered from Hong Kong. 4.4 pounds. I mean, that was a different seizure, but around the same time. 700 Xanax bars. Jeez. Were actually fentanyl. And, you know, whoever was buying those thought they were getting Xanax. Also not, you know, the most safest drug, but certainly not life-threatening in the way that fentanyl is.
No, no way at all. Well, you know, it's funny, too, because, you know, and you hear a lot about it today, especially given the political administration. But from time to time, in the background of your writing, it seems as if you, because a lot of this is born of desperation, it seems as if you talk about NAFTA and the World Trade Organization as in part kind of giving rise to this because of the lack of jobs.
Yeah, and especially in those first communities where OxyContin abuse really broke out, what my research shows is that the opioid makers and distributors targeted the communities where, well, OxyContin in particular, their sales rep targeted the communities where there were already high rates of disability, and mainly because there were a lot of people using competing opioids like Percocet and Vicodin, which were not as strong. And they thought, well, we'll start with the communities where we already know there are a lot of people using opioids, and then try to press those doctors to prescribe OxyContin instead because of the 12-hour time release that was now going to let people have 12 hours of uninterrupted pain so they could sleep through the night, right? And so they started trying to switch from those shorter-acting opioids to the longer-acting opioids. But, of course, the many users discovered immediately that if you put them in your mouth, if you put the OxyContin pills in your mouth, soaked off the coating, you could then crush it up and snort it or liquefy it and shoot it up. And you get all of that 12-hour dosage in one hit. A huge, you know, euphoric rush. And so that started happening almost from the very beginning. And so the way I chose to tell that story was to focus on this one very rural county and two people or three people in particular that were fighting back, trying to get the company's attention, trying to get them to reformulate the drug as early as 2000. I mean, it wasn't reformulated until 2010. But there's this country doctor and this activist nun who are just really going at them, trying to get them. And then they get organized with some parents. You're starting to see overdoses all over the country. And the parents, this is in the age before the internet, a group of parents who had lost children to OxyContin overdose, they began, you know, sort of banding together. And they called themselves Relatives Against Purdue Pharma.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're such heroes and it's such hard work. And you portrayed as being thankless for such a long time, and yet they keep at it and keep at it, especially the nun, just a little fire plug.
Yeah, she's in her mid-80s now, and she still works more hours than I do. She's now a drug addiction counselor. I mean, works every day. I mean, she could probably take me, Sam. She's about 4'10", and she's just amazing. She and Dr. Van Zee, that first doctor that was complaining about the drug, he was starting to see kids he had immunized in his clinic overdosing. One overdosed in the high school library. This is the late 1990s, 2000. God. He wrote Purdue a letter saying, I fear, you know, we are the canary in the coal mines. I fear we are like New York and San Francisco were in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. It is so much worse than I can even tell you it is. And yet he was sort of met with derision, not only by the company, but by his peers, who were very much being hammered with this pain is a fit vital sign, and sort of portrayed Dr. Van Zee as a kook.
Talk a little bit, since you just mentioned it, talk a little bit about the history of Purdue, and then taking it forward to one of my least favorite persons representing them.
Well, it started out as a small company in the 1950s. It was famous for, you know, betadine, which, you know, the astronauts were, you know, washed down with after their big mission. And they made this product called MS Cotton in the early 90s, which was another, it was a morphine derivative, I believe. And just as the patent on that was about to expire, they came out with OxyContin, which was an oxycodone with the time release mechanism. And that was like the new discovery, was the time release mechanism, which they claimed made it less prone to abuse. They said it could only be abused in less than 1% of cases. Which, you know, in it's hindsight, ridiculous. Looking back, it's like you can hardly believe anybody believe that, because right away in Lee County, the county I'm writing about, people, you could tell who was using. I don't remember this in the book, because the people I told you, they would suck the pills and suck the coatings off. Yep. People would walk around with like green and orange smudges on their shirts where they had wiped the coating off the 40 and the 80 milligram pills.
And you could tell by the color of their sleeves whether it was a 20 or 40 or 80. That was really striking. I mean, that really hit home for me.
One of the early police detectives that was the first cop I could find in Big Stone Gap, Virginia, which is just over the border into Wise County, remember the first time anybody ever, any informant ever told him about the drug. He said he leaned over into my cruiser and he said, "This feller's got this new drug up the street that's on the market now, and he's you know, black marketing it. And he says it's like nothing you've ever seen." And the cop says, "What's it called?" And he said, "OxyContin." So didn't quite get the name right, but like immediately the police saw that it was being illicitly sold and abused.
Well, bringing us further forward with Purdue, and I really do want to talk about this because of the way he's in the news every day now, is who did they get to represent them and why?
Right. So the federal government starts investigating the company for various things. In 2007, a settlement happens in Abingdon, Virginia, which is not far from Lee County, about an hour and a half, actually. It's kind of the westernmost U.S. attorney federal courthouse in the state of Virginia. And during the years leading up, this investigation, I think, began in 02 or 03. It ends with the settlement, $634.5 million that the company paid for criminally misbranding the drug. And three of the executives were brought in for that. And during the last few months of the negotiations, Purdue hired Rudy Giuliani to be their spokesman, because they were starting to get all these civil lawsuits, that most of which were being dismissed out of hand, and then this federal case was ongoing. And so Giuliani then handled some of the negotiations with the federal prosecutors, who were actually based in Roanoke, where I'm based. And so I was able to recreate what happened between them and some of the prosecutors that were negotiating with them. And of course, you know, the prosecutors here feel like they kind of looked upon Western Virginia as, you know, podunk. What are these country lawyers going to be able to dig up on us? We won all these cases. They had won so many cases, scores of cases, hadn't lost a single case. What are these podunk country lawyers going to be able to get on this that, you know, others elsewhere haven't been able to? And of course, just through really hard work, this tiny office in Abingdon, Virginia, working through the Roanoke headquarter office, assembled a massive amount of evidence against them. And so you see that being brought out in the settlement agreement. Sorry, there's my dog.
It's all right.
In 2007, when the company and the three main executives were finally brought to account.
Well, what about that one tiny drugstore that got, I don't know, 3 million doses of this? From the FDA, isn't there some type of oversight that would have caught that? That's always struck me as odd.
I know. You would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
that was tiny Kermit, West Virginia, in a story broken by Eric Iyer of the Charleston, West Virginia newspaper, won a Pulitzer for it last year. And, you know, they showed that, like, millions of pills were going to this tiny town that had, like, fewer than 500 people. And so that's why you see the distributors now being folded into this multi-district case that is going forward, like, with states, localities, counties, 500 different lawsuits now being folded into this settlement process overseen by a federal judge in Cleveland, who, by all accounts, is really taking this seriously. The first hearing, he said something like, while we're meeting today, 116 people are going to die of opioid overdose. Like, he's not playing around. He wants meaningful solutions to the crisis. And I'm so hopeful that, unlike in the 2007 settlement, where most of the money went for Medicaid, Medicare fraud, and back to the localities, to the criminal justice side, I'm so hoping that money, whatever comes out of the settlement against the opioid makers and distributors, will go into treatment, because that's needed more than anything right now, as I think story after story of my book point out.
What's so scary to me is that, well, it's all scary, but the fact that, you know, you focus on a corridor in the Northeast that works very well for trafficking, but now this is extended to essentially our entire country, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I did was, so I know where I live, and I believe where I live is a microcosm of America, and it is, truly. I started out, as I said, you know, with when heroin hit my community in a big way, and then I traced it back to the rural area. So, like, coal miners losing their jobs in Appalachia at the same, were abusing OxyContin and using it to sell to pay their bills as well, by the way, as were, you know, loggers and fishermen in Maine and other rural areas. So this is all kind of happening. I mean, OxyContin was a national, it sort of nationalized the supply of opioids after 100 years where we were very, very, very careful about only prescribing opioids for serious, like, cancer, pain, and end of life, right? So the whole thing changes. And as, you know, the pills get harder to get and there's more awareness about them, people who are already addicted, because that's the whole thing. I mean, I call the book Dope Sick because that is what's driving them. I mean, believe me, no heroin addict that I interviewed wants to be a heroin addict. They're continuing to use because they don't want to be dope sick. And it's this, like, outsized fear of the pain that they're going to feel, vomiting, sweating, diarrhea, everything. And so they began then using heroin in the cities and the suburbs. And as I point out, in the Roanoke section of the book, you know, when the kids in the suburbs are doing it, it's much easier to hide because they have money to hide it. Out in the coal fields in the little towns, you see people stealing rototillers and lawnmowers in daylight to pawn to buy pills to keep from being dope sick. But in the suburbs, where kids can just say, hey, mom, you know, I lost my iPad, or my iPad got stolen, when in fact I pawned it so I could buy more pills so I wouldn't get dope sick. And so it reaches different communities in different ways. And so I try to show that, again, as a microcosm of the country through my area, starting in the rural western part, coming to the cities and suburbs, and then more recently to kind of pristine farm towns, which is standing in for, like, Anywhere USA, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, they had people who were misusing pills too, but in 2012, early 2013, this twice-convicted heroin dealer lands and brings heroin to one tiny small town. And almost overnight, they went from having a handful of heroin users to hundreds. And so that's that portion of the story, too. I mean, there is virtually no corner where this isn't a problem in America.
Yeah, and then you talk about user dealers that I never really thought about. And then also the vast amount of increased profit margin by coming down that way rather than selling the stuff in New York.
Yeah. I mean, especially the dealers, the pure dealers, not the user dealers, but the people who are just in it for money. They realize they can sell it for so much more in Woodstock, Virginia than they can in D.C. or Baltimore, you know. And so that was what was happening in the case of the story I was just talking about.
Yeah, it was a real business.
But in Roanoke, I tell the story of this suburban young woman who goes up to New Jersey 2-3 times a week because she has a nice new car, and the addicted people know they can count on her to go get it. And She starts bringing it back. So that's another way it travels on I-81 and other highways. She's buying it at a cheaper price, and then she's selling it here to feed her own addiction, because then, you know, she can get her own cut of it for free. And it's not so much a profit thing. She, again, is sort of propelled to do this. This is a paralegal with a degree from Jerry Falwell's university. I mean, kind of the last person you would think would be shooting up in a law firm restroom. And yet there she was until the day she gets pulled over because the cops are onto her, and they put a GPS tracker on her car, and they pull her over and they catch her with bricks and bricks of heroin. And she's, you know, she's now in federal prison, and her son is being cared for by her grandmother. And that's where we are.
It's horrible. You talk about how women like that, especially women, they aren't suspects because they drive in a nice Toyota Corolla, you know, whatever kind of car that's late model. They're dressed nicely, and no one would ever think of stopping them.
Yeah.
Oh, and also the way on the bus, you know, how, you know, tell some of the ways that it's hidden, like the bricks in the Walgreens bags and stuff like that.
Sure. Well, this case I was mentioning earlier in the small town of Woodstock was so interesting. Wrapped up in 2013, although, you know, people were still being sentenced as late as 15, but it became one of the largest cases in Virginia, and I was able to sort of get the details because it had basically been closed right when I arrived on the scene as a reporter trying to figure out, you know, what was happening. And so, I mean, the first time I heard about this case, this prosecutor I'm interviewing pulls out this chart. He had to make a chart. He had to, like, visibly, like, draw a chart of this heroin ring just in order to keep the people straight. Of course, at the people on the bottom of the pyramid, many of the names were crossed out because they had already overdosed and died. And at the top of this chart were two dealers, one of whom's name was Ronnie Jones, and he's the one I interview in prison in the book.
Right.
But he ends up selling drug runners, they're also called mules, to Harlem to get heroin that he then sells through sub-dealers in the rural community where he's landed. And one of the ways that they, you know, so he sends these unsuspecting white women, and the heroin is packaged in Pringles cans, and
right,
they're sort of like the shape of hockey puck, and then the top is re-glued on with a hot glue gun, and it just looks like they're bringing snacks back on the Chinatown bus to Virginia. And so you wouldn't, I mean, it's just so easy to hide heroin, no matter whether it's coming over the border or whatever, or coming in the mail or coming in Pringles cans.
With a few chips
and
on top.
That was just an example of, that was the story that I was able to use to illustrate how borders are, you know, just so, it's so easy to, for this drug, you know, they put one dealer in prison and then four more sprout up to take his place.
Yeah, and like you said, like you were quoting Biggie Smalls about, don't get high on your own supply. You got these dealers that would never think of using their stuff, as opposed to the user dealers who really have a horrible time. But the dealers are just...
Yeah, yeah. And that's why when you hear Donald Trump say we should execute drug dealers, well, I mean, the drug dealers in my book, I mean, some of them are people who don't use, but by and large, they're like high school cheerleaders and former high school football players and tree trimmers and construction workers and the waitress at the fancy restaurant down the street from me. I mean, they're people who are dealing to support their habit.
And then rehab, you know, you talk about the 12-step programs don't really work. Abstinence is one of the ways it does work. But then again, you talk about how, you know, it takes 8 times in a rehab for it to take, if it does take. It's like, it's really disheartening. I mean,
it's really disheartening. I think NA and AA work really good, like for alcohol, but I think this NA and AA aren't a scalable solution for the opioid crisis. So that study that was a guy from Harvard that showed it take 8 years and 4 to 5 treatment attempts to achieve 1 year of sobriety where opioid use disorder is concerned. I mean, most people don't have 8 years. The young woman at the end of my book, she only had 6 years. And because she couldn't get access to the medication-assisted treatment she needed, you know, she was left to fend amid drug dealers and pimps. You know, she was prostituting, so she wouldn't get dope sick. buy her drugs.
Right.
And so that's a death that doesn't get counted in our 116 a day, right? Because so she was murdered because of the lifestyle she was having to lead in order to get the drug, because she couldn't access the treatment that she needed. Over and over again in her story, I think it's just a great example that, you know, she was just let down at every corner. I mean, not by her mother ever, who always stood behind her, but she, you know, she wanted so much to get better in order to become a mother to her son, a good mother to her son again.
And that's another thing that was also really disheartening. And I don't mean to make it sound like the whole book's a downer, but unfortunately, you know, you look at, it's not.
There are some signs of, you know, hope at the end, I think, you know, that some people are figuring it out, right?
Yeah, but the problem what I was going to say was, you know, at first you think it's just these kids or it's just these cheerleaders or housewives or whatever, but then what you make very clear, especially with these loyal mothers who either sometimes don't suspect, but when they do, they stand by their kids, is it doesn't affect just the person using. It affects an entire ring of people, you know, an entire nuclear family.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, I watched people just age before my eyes, like a video on fast forward. I mean, there's this drug court judge I was following for a couple of years, and I watched his hair go from like half and half salt and pepper to totally gray. And every time I would go, he would let me sit in on his drug court, which was so illuminating. But I would always go back to his office after, and he would just kind of look at me plaintively, and he's like, Beth, what are we going to do? I'm like, you're asking me? And you see these first responders, not just the families, but also the first responders, the EMTs and the doctors and the counselors, and just worn out.
Well, what about the detectives? You have it's a real detective story too, which that part I found really fascinating and almost like a movie, where they're working so hard that they too are in danger of losing their families.
Right. Like one of the main drug detectives I don't think he was married, but he and his partner split up during the investigation of this case. And the other guy, the ATF agent, who is so heroic and really goes after this guy, this big drug dealer, his wife told him, like, you've got to take a desk job. I just talked to him the other day. He's bored out of his mind at his desk job, but, you know, it was that or he needed to take a break from it. I mean, there's that moment during the investigation when the wife comes by the unmarked place where is sort of their headquarters, where they're working the case out of, and they've got the chart up on the wall and whatever, and his kids come in to see him, and the little girl says, Daddy, is this where you live now?
Yeah, that hit me too.
Yeah.
And the chart was amazing too, because you said, you know, like you said, at the bottom in the user dealers, the bottom you have people crossed off. And it's just, well, okay.
Yeah, and then I had to sort of work backwards on that. I started with the chart and just sort of pulled the strings, and finally asked one of the police, local police up in Woodstock. I said, well, who's a family member I could talk to? And then that's how I got to Christy and to Jesse's story. And when I saw, here's this bright woman, you know, civic-minded, who just didn't understand how it was her only son is dead of a heroin overdose. She thought he just did pills, in quotes. And she just couldn't figure it out. And I thought, that's such a metaphor, like, for our country doesn't understand. Like, I don't understand either. Like, let's figure this out. How do we get to where we are, and how do we get out of it? And that was kind of, I had the moms in the back of my mind as I was trying to figure out the narrative arc of the story.
Yeah, it's funny about the arc, because in part it began because of the docs, because, you know, they were seduced by these drug reps who always are handsome or beautiful and come in and explain every week why this is great and give them junk.
And bringing savory food.
Yeah, lunch every,
Christmas trees, and they were always on the young side of middle age, looking good, tan, and, you know, doing their jobs. And actually, Purdue Pharma sales reps were incentivized to get doctors to prescribe ever higher milligrams. Like, the higher the milligram prescribed, the bigger the bonus was.
Yeah,
so you can see how that just led. And then the company, you know, sent docs on free trips for medical education, and you know, I have an OxyContin branded beach hat that Dr. Van Zee loaned me so I could take a picture of it. You know, they would give them, you know, all kinds of gifts. Swing music with an elderly couple dancing on the front, talking about how this drug was going to just put the spring back in your step, and always emphasizing that it's safe. You know, only less than 1% are going to get addicted to this. This is going to make your life better.
And you don't even talk about, really, you know, what really always bothered me. And actually, you know, I practiced law for a long time and did a lot of nursing home cases. And it's like the way they warehouse, especially these old women, just by giving them OxyContin. And there they lay getting decubitus ulcers. And they have no say about it. They don't even, you know, they're not even trying to get high. They just want them to not bother them every day. And, you know, these orderlies are getting paid minimum wage, and they just want to keep these people quiet. It's just,
that's a whole nother sad book, isn't it?
Yes.
Come on, Sam, we gotta
to close it out on a high note, if you can do that, and
I'll
again
try.
Towards the end of the book, I mean, all of your books are very purposeful, and they are trying to get a message through. They're also very entertaining, and it's really hard not to identify with your characters. It's about, like I said, especially these cops and detectives. But in this book, if you were going to end on a high note, what do you think are the things being done now? I mean, I can watch ex-Governor Christie, on the TV talking about in New Jersey, and we're going to do all this, call this number. But I don't know if that's going to do anything. What is going to be the impetus that solves this problem, if any?
Right. Well, I think I say several times in the book, this is an epidemic caused by, you know, massive over-treatment. And the moment someone's addicted, it becomes a healthcare scarcity issue. They can't get access to treatment. You know, the doctors that prescribe this medication-assisted treatment, they have to be waivered and certified. And many doctors don't want to become waivered and certified because they have to go get waivered and certified. But also there's all these regulations and the stigma. They don't want, quote, addicts in their office, many of them. I mean, they don't say that out loud, but you know that's part of it. And so, like, compared to France, which has made it not so cumbersome, any doctor, you've gone to medical school, you can prescribe all the opioids you want, right? In France, they let anybody prescribe, who's a doctor, prescribe buprenorphine, and they enhanced coverage of buprenorphine tenfold, and overdose deaths went down 87%. I mean, I think it's not a perfect drug, but we know it helps in a lot of cases. And so I think there's a lot of education we need to do about, I call it MAT, medication-assisted treatment, buprenorphine, methadone, for the most common forms. And at the end of the book, and there's a lot of stigma about them. Law enforcement tend not to like them, like use of the drugs, because they're easily diverted and abused and, you know, sold on the black market. But the thing is, if you're buying illicit Suboxone, at least you're not getting fentanyl in it. You're getting a pharmaceutical-grade product. So there's a lot of stigma to work against, and there's just a lot of work that I think needs to be done on this concept of harm reduction, which is we're going to try to keep the people who are using now safe until they're ready for treatment. So you have a lot of states enacting laws allowing for syringe exchange. Many communities, including where I live in Roanoke, don't want to open a syringe exchange because they feel like it's a political hot potato.
Right.
Our police chief just came out against it, saying it would be condoning illegal activities. And in states where, I've been to some syringe exchanges, and you just see that what the addicted need most of all is a low threshold access to treatment. Because these aren't people who can make phone calls and do the paperwork for Medicaid. I mean, we have people living on the streets, prostituting in order to get this drug. Former honor roll students, you know, just it's this drug spares no one. And what they really need is this a place they can go where they'll be triaged and referred for treatment. And in the meantime, if they're not yet ready for treatment, they'll be tested for hepatitis C. Many, many opioid users have hepatitis C from sharing, you know, needles, and tested for HIV, and ideally referred for treatment. Virginia just passed the Medicaid expansion just a couple months ago. That hasn't even trickled down, but that'll be a huge help in Virginia, that helping access treatment to MAT.
Okay, I think that's as close as we can end on a high note. But
you know, there are these heroes out there working in all three localities. There are these heroes out there. And honestly, Sam, it was the only way I could stand to live in this material, was to focus on them, people doing this amazing work, often at great expense to themselves and their own families, because it's the right thing to do.
And, you know, it must have been totally wearing on you as well. And I can't even in all your books, it just seems like, you know, you're doing so much work, and some of it's so, it's got to get to you after a while. It must get to you after a while, just like the judge you were talking about.
Yeah, it does. It does. I just had lunch with Patricia, who is Tessa's mom. Tessa's the main character in the last third of the book. And, you know, she's like, how you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm holding up. But it's been tough. And I feel like I can't even say that out loud to a mother who's lost her daughter, right?
Right.
And she's just going on. She's working, and she has a lot of things to do. And it's almost like it hasn't quite hit her, the gravity of it all. And you see, you know, it happening months after someone dies. It this wave of grief. You know, we all process grief differently. But thank you for, that was a nice way to express that. It has been tough. It's been by far the hardest book I've done.
Well, the only thing I can do is, I happen to own an independent bookstore, and, you know, this book is on our front table and will continue to be so, not just because it's a good book, but because there's so many people that really don't have the slightest idea. And we also have a nonfiction book club, and we'll be reading your book in the next couple of months. So thank you.
I really appreciate that, Sam.
Well, I appreciate the book, and I appreciate what you've done, and all your hard work. And I thank you so much for being with us today. I think
it was terrific. Really nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you, too.
And best wishes with your store.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care, Sam.
You too. We were talking with Beth Macy about her book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. And it's horrible. I mean, we all have heard stuff about the opioid crisis. But if you read this book, it just breaks your heart. All of these kids, good kids, football players, cheerleaders that, you know, their parents don't know. You know, no parents know. They don't want their kid to be doing pot. They don't want their kid to be having underage sex. They don't want their kids to be addicted to something. They don't want them driving their car recklessly. But no parent can know. And in this area of depressed people who are unemployed, it's just something that you get started on because you get a prescription, and then all of a sudden you find out that it's something that you can't live without. And so, like I said, yeah, we will keep this book on our shelves because there's so many people that don't know about it, and this book gives a really good litany of all the people and all the roles they play, whether they've died, or whether they're trying to stop it, or whether the doctors or the company that initiated this whole thing to start with, who Rudy Giuliani represented. So in any event, it's not the happiest book that I would say you can read, but I think it's one of the most important books you can read. And as I said, I really appreciate her being here and talking about it. And as usual, I think we have some really good books coming up, and I'll try and get them here for you with 1 second. But it's a shame because this is something that never had to happen, and it did. And now it's like it's almost impossible to get the genie back in the bottle again. And given the current administration, I don't know whether there's going to be enough money to even start doing it. But in any event, yeah, I didn't bring my list of upcoming authors. There's a bunch of them. But if you continue to join us every week, you'll be sure to hear them. And for a complete schedule, which will have the authors that I don't have here, visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com or simply download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. It's easy to do. You can just look up the name of the author, name of the book, or the name of the show, The Avid Reader on WCHE. So thanks very much for joining us today, and look forward to having you with us next week on The Avid Reader.